Welcome to another episode of Renal's World. This is episode 53. And this week I was joined by Jamie Klinger, who, just like most of my other guests, I've also met on Twitter. I spoke to Jamie about her work as an activist and campaigner with Reclaim the Streets, which was set up just after the tragic death of Sarah Everard. And not only has she been incredibly busy working to create a safer space for women, but she's also spent the last year focusing on her health. And if you do follow Jamie, you'd already know that she's lost an incredible amount of weight. But not only did she do that, but she also decided to quit drinking alcohol forever. And this decision impacted her life in so many ways, and you'll hear about it all on the podcast. But before we dive into the show, please remember to subscribe on your podcast app and leave a review on your iTunes. It'll help us to reach out to more people. So thank you all for joining me again this week. And without further ado, here's Jamie Klinger. Welcome to the show, Jamie. Thank you so much for joining me today. I'm not really sure when I started following you or when you started following me or when we got in touch. This whole year has been a big blur, but it's really nice to like just sit down and have a chat with you.
Absolutely. I've followed your work and I've just signed up to your newsletter.
Oh, brilliant. I need to check my inbox, and I get very excited when someone signs up because I've just started it. So you're probably one of the first people who signed up, Jamie. I've just started it, and it's nice to see that I have one fan already.
Good.
How have you been, Jamie?
I've been good. The last week and a half, 2 weeks has been pretty rough. We were in high court last week, and then reading about Dr. Duff and her experience with the Met has been quite shaking. I didn't know I could still be so angered and so shocked, which in some ways it's a good thing because I'm not desensitized to all of it. But the idea of fighting them for 9 years, like, I don't know how she's still alive, because the belittling, the gaslighting, the nobody being held accountable for what was basically like state sanctioned sexual assault is just beyond shocking. For giving a legal advice card to a child and then denying it for 8 years, like, everyone should be absolutely up in arms about what happened to her. And oh my gosh, sorry.
It's all right. It's fine. We're allowed to have sound effects.
sorry about that. So between last week and this week, it's just been quite difficult to see how the Met is characterizing women and seeing how much denial there is. And there's just no efforts to reform or to make it a safer environment. And when you're doing things like that, that means the people you're recruiting are in this rotten core, and you're getting people drawn to power, not public service. And it makes it more dangerous for the good cops and the good officers that are out there. So it's just this like tsunami of bad behavior.
So Jamie, just for our listeners who are tuning in, do you want to just tell us a little bit about Professor Duff's case? Because so, I've read about it, but I'm sure you're probably reading into a lot more detail.
Yeah, so in Stoke Newington, she was in an off license and saw a child that was 15 or 16 get stopped by the police for a stop and search. And she handed a legal card to them saying, these are your rights. And so they took her in and she refused to give her name. And so they handcuffed her and they tied her wrists together and they cut off her clothing. And the staff sergeant said, I don't care, treat her like a terrorist. And they talked about the smell of her underwear and the smell of her vagina. And they held her arms behind her back while they cut off her clothing. And there was video of all of it and nobody got in trouble. And it took 8 or 9 years of fighting them to get them to admit and apologize and to share the video to the media to prove that she was exonerated and that it happened. And like, I just can't deal with it. Like, I can't deal with a woman that committed no crime, anybody, even if they committed a crime. Like, how is that acceptable? Mm. And he, the staff sergeant that ordered the strip search of her, he was cleared in 2018 of any wrongdoing. And it's like, what are we doing here? How, these are the people that I'm supposed to trust?
Yeah. And I think the scary thing is, Jamie, is that these are the stories we do hear. What worries me is what about the ones that we don't hear? What about the ones or the women
who don't speak silenced? English? Oh my God.
Yeah, or who don't speak English. I mean, there you go. That's also another one. And I think
I think for someone to be fighting for this long takes, well, I mean, resilience isn't even enough. It takes a lot more than that. And it must be very, very exhausting. But obviously, Jamie, I can see, like, the way you're talking about it, it's something you're very passionate about. And I can see
how... We were in court last week and, like, yeah. Just sitting there and hearing them speak about us like we're stupid little girls. I'm not stupid. And talking about the difference between illegal and unlawful and contravening restrictions. And it's basic stuff. It's silencing, belittling behavior. And this is us with fancy lawyers, that they're still saying that we're not intelligent enough to understand the difference between unlawful and illegal.
And do you think they're just like sort of playing on words, trying to find loopholes because they can?
I'm so frustrated by it, because if you want reform, if you want change, you want people to come in and open up the doors and to make things better. And by denying, like this week, Krista Dedick said there's no homophobia in the police department. She's already said there's no racism. She's already said there's no sexism, because apparently the police department doesn't operate like the rest of the world. And it's like, if you're not willing to admit there's problems, there's no route for fixing them. And the way that people are treated and the way that, like, I can't even deal with everything I've learned in the last year. And I'm absolutely honest about the fact that as a white expat in her 30s, I had no dealings with the police. I never thought about them. They were just background material.
Yeah.
And in the last year and what's happened and reading about like 750 cases of sexual misconduct and 1 in 10 that get found guilty of gross misconduct lose their job. If you or I got guilty of gross misconduct, we wouldn't have a job.
Yeah.
And like, why is this the case of the people that are supposed to protect and serve while they're holding open the door for number 10? And it's just, it's the double standard. And it's that had they had not acted the way they acted about the vigil, we would have had a vigil with 500 people, 2 or 3 camera crews, and I would have gone back to my real life and we would have never met. Like it would have just been a moment of silence of women in Clapham Common crying. What they did by trying to shut us up and silence us and belittle us was create all of this and create monsters. Yeah. Like the worst thing you can do is tell me to shut up, because then I'm done. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And like Krista Dedick going at a home affairs committee and saying we were naive young women. I'm 43 and I run events. Like I'm not naive. Mm. Well, I was naive until all of this.
Yeah. I can empathize with you, Jamie, because as I've said before on the podcast, said before I went out to protest, I thought, you know, England and the UK was the land that everybody should be in. It's a country where you can achieve things that you can't do in your own country. And it's a country where opportunities are given to you. And I felt grateful to be here. And it was just last night, actually, Jamie, we were watching, I think it was either PMQs or on YouTube, we were watching it with my husband. And I asked him, I said, was it always this corrupt? Because my husband was born here, and I just wonder, has it always been like this? And we just haven't known. It's just maybe the pandemic has allowed sort of everything to just simmer through the surface because everything's been at boiling point. And you just, it's kind of scary to know that maybe more people would have gotten away with it if this, all of this during the pandemic hadn't happened.
It's also the semantics around you and me. Like I moved here for a job. I am an immigrant and I've been here 20 years, but it's like, I'm never called an immigrant because I'm white, middle class, and media. Like no one ever, ever calls me anything but an expat. And those semantics and the leave and the remain, and like Brexit was a much better marketing ploy than remain, you know, and it's those words, but it's the way that people will talk to me about it because I'm white and I am well-spoken and the amount they put me on the media, rather than women that have suffered, you know, like women that should have the platform that we've been given. And so a lot of what we did, like we did a vigil with Mina Smallman about Biba and Nicole, because their case got nothing at the beginning. Mm. They weren't on the cover of anything. And it was the most horrific case, you know, and sisters at a birthday party in a park, you know, like, what are we doing that's possible?
It's very interesting, Jamie, because you've come from the US and I know that the police department in the US isn't also the most perfect police department in the world. And I was reading up somewhere where they tallied and they did a survey to see how people get employed in police departments around the world. And it showed that in the US, it showed that in places like Scandinavia, for example, you need to have like a degree, you need to have some level of training to get into the police force. Whereas in countries like the US, I'm not entirely sure about the UK, but even if you don't have a degree, you just need to pass high school and then you can get into the police force. So there's no, you know, rigorous system to filter people to get into that post. And I think that could be a big part of why we're seeing, you know, all of this happen around us. And obviously we saw what happened in the Capitol last year when Biden was going to come on as president. We saw what happened over there. We saw what happened with Black Lives Matter. And I'm sure that frustrated you just as much as what we're seeing here.
I just find it really problematic. Like, with the people I know in America that became cops, it's either the bullies that end up with guns or the people that were bullied that end up with guns. I love that the police don't have guns here. And I'm not somebody who's defund the police or anti-police, but what I've learned about what happens when policing goes wrong in this country has shocked me to the core. And the lack of accountability, the lack of showing it, the lack of being honest about it. They spend so much more time and money keeping it hidden. Like, there was a guy in Hampshire who was specifically trained about domestic violence and was inappropriate with a domestic violence victim. He was removed from the force because of his inappropriate gross misconduct, and they voted to give him lifelong anonymity for his welfare. What about my welfare? Like, that means he can be private security in a club that I'm at when I get roofied. Why is welfare more important than mine? And this anonymity thing, like, you committed crimes with a badge when the bar should be higher. The level and standard of your conduct should be higher than the normal guy on the street. You shouldn't hide behind a badge you don't deserve.
Well, Jamie, you know, just going back to Professor Duff, you said that, you know, the case has been going on for 9 years. I also feel like the system has been made to tire us out, so we just give up. I was very fortunate in the sense that we had a crowd justice page, and people donated, and our lawyers, I mean, we didn't have to pay a single penny for our legal case, which we're very, very grateful for, because we created change which would have never had happened if we didn't have the funds for it, because you need lawyers to do this. But I feel like the system is made, and, you know, just going back to what you were saying about people saying it's unlawful or it's illegal, like, you know, people find ways to cover things up because this is just the way the world works, unfortunately. What gives you that sort of fire and fuel to say, no, I'm going to keep going? Because, and I say this because the other day when another news broke out about Boris Johnson having a party, I actually just threw my phone. I was like, I can't deal with this anymore. Am I going to keep tweeting about it for the rest of my life? Like,
I tweeted with effing and blinding, and I was like, I find it lazy to use curses, but my tweet about an effing birthday party got a million impressions.
Yeah.
And I was furious. But it's this whole idea that, like, why are you holding the door and being bouncers for them while you're kneeling on our backs? Like, how are you marrying that type of behavior? You've got the amount of money you've spent on lawyers to fight us for our human rights because you didn't allow us to express ourselves, because you said it wasn't a reasonable excuse while you had your officers witness parties. Are you kidding me? Like, are you out of your mind? And the arrogance that you thought you could cover it up, the arrogance that they thought it was never going to come out.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I've learned over the last few months, and it's something that Catherine Mayer had mentioned in the podcast a few weeks ago, she said that we have this illusion that linear progress is linear. We think that, you know, three generations we'll just see progress happen, and we don't expect it to go backwards, whereas progress isn't like that. We have to have these setbacks. And as I, you know, I've said this before, I think some of these setbacks have been important in some way, but obviously it's come to a huge, huge cost.
Yeah, the pendulum of...
Yeah, and you know, it's very difficult to sort of find that balance, but I do think, like, the last year has been a huge, huge wake-up call. And I know that Reclaim the Streets was founded off, you know, you saw what happened with Sarah Everard's case, and then you put something out on Twitter and that sort of blew up. So what actually happened there?
So on the Monday, I had tweeted that urban women deserve the right to get home and that my heart was breaking for her family. It didn't say anything groundbreaking, but it got like 700,000 impressions. And so on Wednesday, when her body was tragically found, and on Tuesday, they had arrested Wayne Cousins, I tweeted that I was going to do a vigil. And the reason I tweeted I was going to do a vigil is I was an events manager and I knew all the women's mags because I had worked at Stylist for 10 years. And in that moment, I couldn't sit still. I couldn't not, I hadn't hugged my best friend. I hadn't hugged anyone. I needed to see other women. I needed to give a space for women that were feeling as angry and bottled up and as upset as I was. And journalists were like, oh, some local women are doing it too. So Wednesday, we joined forces and they'd gone to the council and to the police. I had emailed the council and the police because if one of us had been like anarchy, it wouldn't have worked. But we both really just wanted the safest possible way for women to come together. And local Lambeth police had said that they were going to find a way to police it. And then on Thursday at 2:30, Scotland Yard said it was illegal and we couldn't go ahead. Then lawyers got involved. We raised £37,000 on Thursday night and we were in high court on Friday. Like it happened so, so quickly.
Wow.
And then at court, they were like, you shouldn't have come to court. The cops have to, or the police have to give you the parameters in which you can go forward. You have to absolutely.
Wait, sorry, Jamie, just to step back. You went to court with what, like, what was your case? What were you?
That the right to assemble. That we had a reasonable excuse to assemble. And like, God, I'm going to mess up word. I'm going to mess up who supported us and who didn't. But Harriet sent a thing to Cressida Dick saying we did have a reasonable excuse and she would be attending. But like all of the media then was focused on whether or not we were allowed to go ahead.
I can't remember, Jamie. Just remind me, was this during a lockdown or was it in between
lockdowns? Yeah, so it was we were under like major lockdown tier restrictions. So it was during lockdown, but yeah. We were saying that the right to protest and the right to assemble was a reasonable excuse not to adhere to lockdown.
Because before all of, I mean, this is one case, but before all of that, we had Black Lives Matter protests. We had, I don't want to say it, but the anti-vax protests, the anti-lockdown protests, so all of that was happening. Would you know if the police were ever involved in that or were there any cases regarding that?
The rules changed so often and so much, but 3 weeks later, Prince Philip died and there were hordes of crowds at Buckingham Palace that were not policed the way we were policed.
Right, okay.
And the night before that, apparently, allegedly, whatever words I need to use, was when the party happened at number 10.
You didn't quote too much, Jamie. You didn't
have one of the 15 parties at number 10 happened with the same restrictions with suitcases of wine. So from my point of view, my whole life has been turned upside down for a year by the police and the police shining a light on us. And like everything that happened with us was reactive. But me calling my father hysterically crying and saying, I'm going to get arrested because I'm going to go forward. Like I'm doing this anyway. And knowing that my life was going to change forever. And what actually happened was we were negotiating with the police. We offered them 12 to 4 and 4 to 8 to have moving memorial lines. We offered them all this stuff. They sent a press release while we were negotiating with them that it was illegal. Like the disrespect and the layers of you're just stupid girls, you're stupid girls, you're stupid girls.
Yeah.
And we met that night for a couple of hours with one of our lawyers. There were 9 of us. I was joking. We were the Clapham 9. Lots of tears. But what actually came out of it was there were 32 satellite vigils that were going to happen. And those organizers were also on the hook for £10,000 and prosecution under the Serious Crimes Act. And what we decided was £320,000 going into the police forces rather than violence against women and girls groups, that we would pivot and we would fundraise for actual violence against women, girls groups, because we might've been able to raise the 90 grand for us. We couldn't guarantee that we could raise the 320 and those women might lose their jobs. They might have bankruptcy. They might lose custody. And they were not at the table to make those decisions with us. So we decided it was gonna go ahead with or without us at that point because of the amount of publicity. We were going to cancel it and save our own liability. And we were going to fundraise instead. And we ended up raising £550,000.
Wow. How long did it take you to raise £550,000?
2.5 days.
Wow. That's crazy.
But again, it was nuts. Like none of it none of it was planned. It was all reactive to the way the police were handling it, us. And that money has gone to ROSA, which is a grant-making foundation, and they're opening up calls for entries for different grassroots organizations that can spend the money and get it to women and girls and help save some lives.
Wow, that's incredible, Jamie. And I remember when I went out for my first protest, and I had all of this in my head because that was the very first lockdown. That was when things were very, very strict. And it, for me, it was a one woman protest, so there was nobody around me. But I spent days planning, like, okay, if I do get other doctors involved, do I socially distance from them? Do we just have a group of people? Like, what happens if we get arrested? Like, will I lose a medical license?
One of my friends who's all techie, he helped give me a list of everybody that was saying they were going to do a vigil. And then I sent a Google Doc to all of those people so that when we had the verdict or the decision, that I could be responsible and tell them. But by publicly sending them the Google Doc, like, I became a ringleader of the whole thing and more responsible for each of them. And instead of it being a responsible way to disseminate information, it was that I was like this kingpin. And again, it's the language, and what we were doing at core was mourning a woman that had been killed at the hands of a police officer. What we were doing was not this big illegal ring. It wasn't these illegal raves. It wasn't partying. It was grieving. And it was grieving. And it was against the men and the police that had come door to door and said the only way we could keep ourselves alive was to stay inside. We were already locked down.
Yeah.
And they used the same restrictions and the same tiered restrictions that got her into that car, they used against us.
And Jamie, you said we set everything up, and who got involved with you, and how did you get in touch with them?
So Twitter. And then we hadn't met in person because of the restrictions for 3 more weeks. We spent 9 days of like 20-hour days on Zoom with each other. There were 9 of us, but then it was supposed to be done on Saturday. It by no means did any of us think that this was going to be our lives or this was going to become what it became. But in effect, by silencing us and by trying to stamp down the attention, there was an uprising and we ended up in the eye of the storm, but inadvertently.
The work that you've done this year has been not just important, but it's necessary. It's needed for this generation and for generations to come. And I know that you've had lots of experience in events before this. So you know what it's like to organize organize big things like this, but it's very far from what you're probably used to. This is a whole new world of like knowing what lawyers want, legal language, dealing with the police, and I guess at some point you might even be dealing with ministers. So how has that transition been for you?
Hard, because I'm mouthy and I curse a lot. Pippa Woodrow, who's one of our barristers, is very much on my speed dial. But a lot of it was, once we canceled, she was like, you're off the leash. You can say anything that you want to say because it's the truth and because of what they said and did to us. And basically, if you let me go for it. And I really, when I was talking to my parents and talking to people at home about what I've said, and they're like, wow, so much press, so much coverage. But actually, at core, I'm not saying anything remarkable. I'm saying I deserve to walk the streets without a pervasive level of fear. I deserve to be alive and get home from work every day and be able to live a life that involves being in public. And everyone's like, yeah, but you're putting the responsibility at men. Well, it is men. If men weren't killing us, if men weren't attacking us, we wouldn't be dead. Mm-hmm. And this is the whole thing that everyone's like, wow, that's profound. It's not profound. It's really, really basic that the violence in society is at the hands of men. It's against other men. It's against other women. But 95, 99% of the violence is at the hands of men. And with all of the cuts to domestic violence charities, violence begets violence. And with all of the cuts to mental health stuff, we are in a crisis of men's mental health, and we are getting stomped down and we are getting killed because of it.
I also feel like we're doing other people's jobs for them. Oh, and they're getting paid to do what you're doing, basically. And I think it's just a whole, you know, it's really important to disrupt the system right now, because even us as doctors, Even what we did with our legal challenge, I was like, there's a committee set up to do this. Why am I doing this? Why am I speaking to lawyers, you know, to set up PPE guidelines? It just made no sense. But I personally, Jamie, I did find it very overwhelming to enter this world of, you know, politicians and leaders and ministers, because it's scary. It's really bloody scary, because you are just one person who just naively and innocently just wanted to create a change. And then it just blows up into this massive thing.
My language isn't, it's not school-like. It's not intersectional feminism and misogyny. It's very much women. Like, it's like all women deserve this. And for some people, they think I dumb it down, but it's much more about the working women that the tube being shut affects. It's about, if it's 97% of women saying they're sexually harassed in public, that's each and every one of us. That's each and every one of our daughters. And it starts really, really young. And we know from our childhoods what it's like to be sexualized way too young and to have our keys in our hands. The Tuesday night, I think when Wayne Cousins got arrested, I did my first Times Radio interview, and there were three of us on it. And I said something about keys in my knuckles. And the host was like, what? I have three daughters. I've never heard that. And I was like, can we call your daughters? Because they do it every night. And he came back on the radio later that night and he was like, I never knew that my daughters thought about. And like, that's the thing, is it's so omnipresent for us and they just don't know, because we're so conditioned to do it all the time. And one of the things I was talking to a guy friend about is the power of where you stand. And I was like, it's much different if you're going to hit on me and we're at a pub and you're hitting on me when I'm at the bar and I can see my friends and you're not crowding my space and I have options, is much different than me coming out of a loo in the basement and the only way to get to other people is through you. And then I need to be careful not to agitate you, not to set you off. Like, that is not an equal playing field where I can be flattered and have a conversation. Mm. That's who can hear me if I have to scream. Mm. And so he's like, I would never think of that. And I was like, that's what you need to do. If you want to be an ally, you need to think about, what is this situation? And is she going to be enjoying speaking to me? And does she have all the options? Is she speaking to me feeling like I can have a little flirt here, I can have a nice conversation? Or is she just trying not to piss you off in case you throw a glass at her? Mm-hmm. And like, I don't want to be histrionic that I get glasses thrown at me all the time. But it's those type of things where if men aren't thinking about their stance or how we're interpreting it, they're not going through the same mental checklist that we are. And they're not worried about their own safety. Like, when a guy gets mugged, he's pissed off about his property. When we get mugged, we're worried about our vaginas. We're worried if we're going to get raped. And that's a much different experience. And the fact that the government not qualifying that as misogyny and not qualifying attacks on our bodies as misogyny is a massive problem.
Jamie, what was it like for you when you were younger? Because you just mentioned walking around with the keys in your knuckles, and you said this Time Radio presenter, he didn't know that his children did that. I've done that personally, and I've never actually spoken about it to my parents, probably not even my husband either, because I don't know, it's just one of those things I feel like we just need to keep secret, just to keep us safe, just get home, just be quiet, and just get the job done. What was it like for you growing up in the States when, I mean, did you feel safe as a young girl?
But Philly and New York are also like, you get beeped at like 40 times a day. So it just becomes background noise rather than actual threat, because you get beeped at all the time. But when we were little, like, we must have been 11 or 12, and there were like four of us walking down the street and this guy yelled something and beeped something gross at us. And we turned around and it was one of the girls' dads. And like, we never spoke to her again, because we knew that if we told our dads would probably end up in jail for killing him. And we were so grossed out, but everybody was driving us everywhere. So we would have had to be in his car. And he was shocked that it was us too. But like, I still feel disgusting about the fact that we ostracized her and we just never spoke to her again, because we didn't have the language to tell on him without getting our dad. Like, there's this whole thing about the danger of our dads getting arrested for hurting somebody that hurt us. And there's this whole fear around protecting your daughters and shotguns with first dates and crap. And so the three of us became friends for 15 years, but we never spoke to that little girl again. And what that did to her confidence, or what that, like, that sticks in my mind as a horrible moment of my childhood.
So what made you move from the States to the UK, Jamie?
So I worked in New York, and a photo agency over here offered to move me here for a year, and I've been here for 20.
So what made you stay, Jamie?
The work to live versus the live to work. I was very much in New York and working all the time and being seen to work all the time. And then I was here and I was a bit exotic. And then I just never left. And then I got a dog and I ended up working at the magazines, and the routes to entry. I grew up quite poor in Philly. And when you're here, everybody thinks that you're richer and smarter and more cultured than you actually are because you're an expat. And so the benefits of being here took away anything about where I was schooled. It took away any class issues because everyone just assumed that I was loaded because I was 22 and I was here.
So it's almost like you started off with a new identity when you came to the UK.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And the accent stays, and I dial it up, I dial it down. And but the opportunity to reinvent myself and to pursue any career here has been amazing.
What's it been like, Jamie, to be, you came from the US and then you came to the UK, and to be trying to, you know, to be working towards creating change at such a grassroots level in a different country? Does it feel weird to you at all? Or does it just feel like, well, borders don't matter to you?
Oh, no, borders matter. It was actually the first time I voted here as a citizen. I voted Lib Dem, and then they did a coalition with the Tories, and I was so confused, and I felt like I'd been duped, and I just didn't understand what had happened. And like, the only protest I had been to here before this was the Trump march and when Trump made the anti-Muslim ban. I was always mouthy on Twitter, and I wrote a bunch on about Trump mostly, and I was anti-Brexit, but I didn't do anything about it. My life was not what you would call political. My mom was super political, and kind of my rejection of that was like, I'm in another country. I don't understand all this. Like, I'm just doing my thing. But now, learning more about like how the courts work and how, like, I've learned so much. A lot of it still doesn't make any sense to me, but feeling stupid, I feel like the police and their arguments about us have very much made me feel stupid. And then I reread it and other people are like, what the hell is this? This is crazy. Mm-hmm. And it justifies how angry and how they've made me feel. And I'm educated, white, middle class, on TV all the time about it. And they still treat me like I am not able to come up with a cognizant argument about why what they did to us was wrong.
Jamie, now that you look at the work that you're doing, do you have any, I mean, I wouldn't say regret, but do you wish that as a younger adult, you were more involved in politics? Because I look back at my time now, and just like you, I didn't care about politics at all. I just thought it was just too much effort to think about it and to have conversations about. And then obviously when I saw the impact that it was having on me, then I was like, okay, now I need to like step up and learn about all of this. But I also kind of wish that I'd done this a lot sooner. Do you have any of those feelings at all?
I was drinking a lot, so I wouldn't have been able to do it. I wasn't in the position or the mindset to have, like, to be able to be on TV and radio all the time and have like succinct killer arguments. I would have just been crying in the pub or crying at people and knowing that there was anger there, but not really being able to communicate it. My best friend is one of the producers for Guilty Feminist. She's been doing the work hardcore for 10 years, and I've witnessed a lot of that. I don't know. Like, that's the thing with Dr. Duff. I don't know how long I'll last. Like, my esophagus has been on fire all week. The anger and the rage and this level of anger being sustained is really, really hard. Like, it's so hard to read the tweets and not cry. Like, to read about another party at number 10 when I was crying about my livelihood and whether or not I was going to actually be in jail. Like, it's really hard to talk about how hard it was to raise the money for the court case. And for me, putting my hat out there was so personal that I felt like I was telling everyone I was poor, you know, like, and the personal and the lines between personal and political and having my face on this all the time and meeting other women in these lines, like that's been the benefit of it, is meeting such incredible women. But the burnout rate, like it is exhausting. It's nothing like when I was at a magazine every day and I sent figures and I was like, this cover did really well. This cover didn't. This is our social media campaigns. This is what we do. You know, like who I am and this are so like transformed together that it's really hard to think about what and who I am without it now.
I can't remember my life before the pandemic. I can't remember the person I was. I think also because part of that was I also became a mother during lockdown and stuff. So I think that's been part of the change. But Jamie, you touched upon the fact that you were drinking a lot. And there's something I did want to talk to you about, because I know you've lost a lot of weight throughout the last year. And see, the weight loss is probably just one sort of side effect of everything that you've done. So just to go back right to the very start, why were you drinking so much? And I asked why, because I've read some of your stuff and you said that, you know, you would have like a boozy brunch and for other people it would be too much. But for you, it was just like, yeah, just a normal day.
I think the real time of when I like was drinking with everyone and then I was drinking way too much was by not having kids and by deciding not to have kids. People moved on and grew out of the phase and I didn't grow out of the phase. And then my mom got sick. And by choosing to stay over here, I was trying to like prove that my life was amazing over here. But the expat life of knowing my mom was dying and not enjoying my life here and not enjoying my life there and being in this awful limbo. And she was dying for 6 years, which is a really extensive amount of time. And like I had 3 leaves of absences while I did chemo with her and stuff. But I was in a rut and I got myself into a point where it was so much a part of my life that I didn't think I could ever get out of it. And that I thought that I would fail at quitting as well. And so the fear of failing at quitting kept me from ever trying to quit. And so it was like this, I was just, that's who I was. I was this drunk girl in the corner and I was really unhappy and I was really in some bad patterns of behavior. And then COVID hit and all of a sudden, like I'm an extreme extrovert at the best of times, but like COVID hitting me, not having work for the first time in my life, being totally by myself and forced to deal with that. And then I got sick. And so I ended up with shingles and I had like blisters on my breast and on my right thigh. And I was terrified and I couldn't go see a doctor. So I was filming it for my brother's wife, who's a doctor. And I thought I was going to die. And I was just like, you know what? I'm done. Because I was Googling like detoxing in Thailand. And I was like, are you kidding me? If I'm paying somebody to make me not drink, I'm just done. And so I wasn't going to drink for the rest of lockdown. And then when I got a little bit closer to when they were opening things up, I was like, well, I'm going to have a month while pubs are open to show that I could recalibrate, to show that I did this. And then my best friend sent me a picture of me at the beginning of lockdown and me then. And she's like, this is what we're all seeing. And I sent it to another friend at a magazine and said, I'd write about it. And they had me talk to a doctor who scared the crap out of me and was like, this is one and done. This is an opportunity of a lifetime. You should never drink again. And no. I never drank again. And that for me, the accountability of publishing it in U Magazine meant I was never going to drink again. So it was like a light switch of this part of my life is over. And then I had on this whole pink cloud thing where I was like, well, if I can deal with that, I should start running. And then once I started doing that and I was like, all right, now I'm going to do Noom, because I was 229 pounds, which I think was like 16 stone or something. And that I ran at 16 stone is nuts. But once I clicked into Noom, like cognitive behavioral therapy for me is like gold dust. Like if I have the tools to change my behavior, I am super committed to goals and I nailed it. So I lost 100 pounds and I run a lot and my whole relationship with food is drastically different. I've never had another drink and I never will. And the reason I share it is like, I feel like I woke up out of a coma. Like I stopped self-sabotaging. I stopped being in my own way. And as soon as I like embraced that, like I stood up and was counted. And any barrier between me and my rage about all of this, I can literally do anything and talk to anybody about this. And I'm good at it. And so like,
yeah, you are, Jamie, very good at it.
But all of that fear, all of that self-loathing, all of the shame, like I'm an attention seeker at heart, but I'm getting such better attention. I get such like I went and did a, I taught a course at Leeds for a day. I did a guest lecture at Leeds University. And those young women in that course, they listen to everything I'm on. They read every article, and they're so like, oh my God, I'm so inspired. Which for me, hearing that from younger women is just amazing. Like, and that's the stuff that keeps me going. Talking to journalist students, like we say yes to every student journalist that wants to talk to us, because they're the ones that have to carry the flag. They're the ones that are going to get this stuff done. And the older women I talk to, Sunday was horrible. My mom missed the biggest week of my life. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't know that I quit drinking. Sorry.
It's okay, Jamie.
But like, she would be so happy. She would just be so proud that I found my purpose and that I didn't let it go, that I didn't let the moment pass because I was sober, cognizant, and aware. I grabbed it with both hands and I made people think and listen.
Wait, Jamie, how do you think this has changed? Like, how is it? I mean, you mentioned how it's changed your life, but how has your eating habits, your drinking habits, everything, you're running now? Like, you sound like a completely different person.
But I actually have kept most of my friends and most of my life. Like, one of my friends was like, oh, are you ever going to eat normal again? My normal is entirely different. But yeah. My normal is incredibly strict when I'm at home. But when I'm out for dinner with people, it's fine because I'm in maintenance now and it's fine. And so it's making better decisions. It's really so much for me is like, when I run, I want to come home and I don't, like, I have no interest in like eating last night's Indian food when I get home from a run. Whereas when I was hungover, it would be like, get me as much salty shit in my mouth. And like, there's no point in trying to diet when you're drinking two bottles of wine a night. And like, you're making, like, I never wanted to spend 5 minutes alone. So I was the last one at the pub. I was bringing people back. I just never, ever wanted to be alone. And now I'm like, oh my God, I've had too much time with people. I just want to be with McNults. I need some space. I need some time. And like, that is the biggest thing that's changed about me, is actually liking who I see in the mirror and wanting to spend time with her and not needing validation from everyone else. Like, I'm validating myself and the work I'm doing rather than being desperate from it for others.
You've changed your life in your 40s. And I think that, you know, I speak to some people who are in their 30s and they're like, yeah, man, I've just wasted my life. I want to lose weight, but I can't. It's too late now. And I think that we set ourselves on these sort of time frames in our life that at this age, we need to do this. And at this age, we need to do that. And even now, at the age of 28, I'm thinking, well, there are a few things that I wish I would have done, but I'm like, I'm still 28. I've still got time ahead of me. But I feel like social media as well, you know, you put a photo out tomorrow and you show your transformation. People will just think, oh yeah, she's just like, you know, she did it in a few months and that's it. But it took so much hard work. It took so much hard work out of you.
It did, but also my body was super receptive to it. Like, I had never dieted and I just didn't know the nutritional information. I didn't have any of that knowledge. And like, it's boring. You do it day in, day out, the amount of calories in versus the amount of calories out. And I was absolutely committed to it. And I did it, you know, and people want to talk about how many times I've fallen off the wagon, or they're like, oh, this is, she got surgery. She got that. And like, I'm like, you can literally watch every week. Like, I haven't had surgery, but I haven't had a hormonal. I haven't had a thyroid problem. I am not the circumstances other people's been in. And the other thing is, I was completely by myself. I've never run with anyone else. I didn't cook for anyone else. So I was able to entirely lock down my kitchen. I was able to never have, like, when I wanted to quit drinking, the bars were shut. When I wanted to quit eating, the restaurants were shut. Like, the fear of missing out was my biggest thing. And that was taken away. So I capitalized on some situations, but like, the little bit of joy, and like, I was so excited to go to the doctors and not lie about how many units I had every week. Like, it was so fun to go back to the doctor and be like, I do not drink anymore. And that's truth. Like, I'm not underestimating. I'm not lying to you about anything. Like, this is who I am now. And like, I'm really, really proud of the work I've done and the time I've put into it and the time I've invested in my mental health as well as my physical health. And like, I did a body scan test thing, and like, I was at 49 when I started and now I'm at 39. And like, I've added 10 years life expectancy by all of this.
Wow.
In a year. Oh, no, it's nuts. And I know I'm extreme. I am extreme. But like, when you talk about bundling and stuff, I know if I had a glass of wine right now, I wouldn't gain 100 pounds and be back where I was. But I have changed so drastically my life, and I'm so proud and so excited for whatever's coming next, which I don't know, that there's nothing that alcohol holds for me that isn't wrapped up in how sad and how numb and how upset I was and how broken I was then. And like, nobody that loves me ever wants me to have another drink.
Were you mainly just upset because of your mother being ill, or were there other things playing on your mind at that time?
Well, there's everything, you know, like there's where you're at in life and what you're doing and how you're doing and what's going to come. But the thing that had changed is people had grown up and matured, and I stayed stuck in a rut that revolved around sitting around and drinking, and wasted a good 15 years of my life.
One of the things that I've seen a lot, we talk about, right, in our like field of work, we're talking about holding politicians to account, the Met Police to account. And I think that on a personal level, we tend to forget to do that quite a lot as well. Even before I gave birth, I said to my husband, I said, I want to make sure I shed off all the weight, because as in our culture, we feed women who've just given birth like ghee, butter, and like, you know, they're breastfeeding, and I've seen women like just put on weight and they just never lose it, because it's silly, really. I mean, there's ways that you can stay healthy, but I feel like that happens because there's no sort of personal sense of accountability, not just with weight loss, but just with, I guess, everything in life. Even as a doctor, we see it like, how good of a doctor do you want to be? Do you want to learn everything? Do you want to be there for your patients? Do you want to go the extra mile? And that personal sense of accountability is also very important. How did you nail that? Because this takes very, very serious discipline. And how did that accountability come? Like, what tools did you use for that?
So Noom, you weigh yourself every day. And like the graph of my weight loss was very compelling to keep going. But also I am that person that once I say it publicly, like I will not ever not do it. Like once it's out there in the world, and I know that accountability for me is very much the lever that makes shit happen for me, because I will never, ever be a hypocrite. So it's, you know, like I know people that have quit drinking publicly and then privately have fallen into something based on their persona. And like, I have booze here, like my ex-boyfriend's stuff is here. And like, there's nothing in that for me. Like I used up my credits. I've done everything there is with that. And I didn't do it with AA or anything. I know that really works for some people and they need that support. And I really, with weight loss, with drinking, with any of it, whatever clicks in your brain that makes you feel better and helps you, that's the route you need to take. Like, I'm not prescriptive. Like, if you do this, you'll get to here. If you eat what I ate, if you run as many steps as I ran, that's going to make it do what it did to my body. But I'm also really, really excited and proud. Like, my mom had a major weight problem and she hated her body. And I rejected dieting because I didn't want to admit where I'd gotten and how uncomfortable I was with my size. And like, I wasn't this size in high school. I was extra large my entire life. And now, like, I thought I was big boned. I thought I had massive breasts and a massive bum, and I just don't. Mm-hmm. And like these fictions or these things that we get stapled into that we believe about ourselves. And that's not coming from anybody else. That was what I believed about my own body. And to find out it's just not true, to find out I can be a runner, to find out, like, I'm not scared. Well, obviously I'm scared of the future because of everything and climate and everything, but like, I'm also open to whatever's going to happen next. Like, I don't know what this is all going to lead to. I don't know what my career is anymore. Like, events have been, I haven't had a job and I need a job. I need to be back in working, but I might've grown out of events, you know, like figuring out the next steps, but it's figuring them out with an excitement and a curiosity that was gone. And instead of looking at rock bottom and circling it and figuring out, like, I searched for rock bottom for a long time and I don't know the minute that it switched, but I am so, so glad that I gave myself a chance and I believed that it was possible, because that was the first thing that made all of this happen.
Do you think you're going to go back into events at all now? Because Reclaim the Streets, everything that you're doing now seems to take a lot of your time. Is this something that you'd go into full time as an activist, or
I'm not sure how you monetize it. I don't know. Like,
that's a very good question, Jamie, because, you know, I spoke to someone a few months ago and someone made a very good point, and they said that you can be a campaign and activist if you're privileged enough, if you don't have to worry about rent, if you don't have to, you know, you can just go out there and just do what you love doing. But unfortunately, a lot of us need to pay bills. So,
and I'm talking to people about doing audits for companies on women's safety and their hiring practices and their sexual harassment reporting things. And I think there's room for that. But I also need to really work out what that looks like and how that happens. But this has been all encompassing for a year, and it's exhausting. So how much, when you take it that personally, like, people that are a spokesperson for a company aren't like, I could go and be a spokesperson, but if it's not something that I feel the way I feel about women's safety about, would it read as engaging and as important? Because all of it is just actually me. It's not this put upon thing. It's this authentic self. And we don't get, like, people think I get paid to go on news and radio, and I'm like, no, and I haven't gotten a dime from any of that. That is literally like being on call all the time and saying yes. And like, I really like LBC because I'm hitting an audience that I wouldn't hit otherwise. And I'm getting conservative men that agree with me that we shouldn't be scared the way we are. And like, I'm not scared to grapple, but when you're not saying anything crazy, like, I'm not asking for men's curfews. I'm not asking for anything outlandish. I'm asking to stay alive.
What would you say to someone who was in your position? Because you said that you've always like been angry about stuff, about politics and anything else. And previously you would have a drink in the pub and you'd just stay there and just rant about it. But now you've actually taken some action. I know that there are a lot of people listening in who probably feel the same way, who feel very angry about what's going on around us, but not necessarily sure how to take action. So what advice would you have for them?
I think the first route is really to be a safe space and be a mentor and an ally for women around you. Like, for me, knowing that younger women can come to me and speak to me and I can help them with the dilemma that they're facing or what they're trying to grapple with, and without judgment. Because I think a lot of times with younger women, especially in the media and in advertising and stuff, it's like, well, we were drinking or there was drugs, and can I really report this to work if there were drugs involved? And it's all of that where we are our biggest detractors. Like, we've gotten to a point in society where if we're sexually assaulted, we're in our heads being like, would a jury believe me? Not, were my boundaries crossed? Did it happen? We're thinking like, oh, is anyone going to believe me? Are the cops going to make fun of me? Like, we're so far ahead because of entertainment stuff that we're not actually asking the main question, which is, were my boundaries crossed? Did I not say yes? Did something happen that makes me feel like I was violated? And we've lost the sense of that because we're way ahead of ourselves thinking about, is it prosecutable? Will the cops believe me? Not the basic of, did I get hurt? Is my heart hurt? Is my body hurt? Am I scared because of what happened to me? And we've lost taking care of that person and making that person have a space to be honest to themselves and to their friends. And so it gets it's 2 a.m. and people start telling their rape stories when everyone's drunk, when women are alone, rather than us taking care of that girl that got hurt and us fostering our own self and believing our own selves and taking care of that trauma. We've gotten way far away from that. And so if you can help take care of your friend's trauma and your trauma and believe women, that's a really powerful thing that's not existing right now, especially with young women. And so little tiny, tiny acts of rebellion, of trusting and believing and giving space for those conversations to happen sober, I think gets us a lot further.
Yeah, and I think, you know how they say charity starts at home. I think it's the same with activism. I think it's really important to have those dinner table conversations, even if they are uncomfortable. Because, as I said, going back to what I was saying about social media, where we see lots of people make so much change in the world, but it's not as easy as it looks. It really isn't. It takes a lot. And I think you can convince.
And it's hard. And when people are telling you their stories online and you don't know them, or they're tagging you in every rape that happens, your brain explodes and you cry and you're under the covers a lot, you know, and I need taken care of. And my dog has been cried onto a million times, and my best friends have been amazing, but like, I've become really hard to buy for, because you can't just send me wine. You can't just send me cookies. it's become a different area for me. But like this month is the first month I've not been able to read since my mom died. And I just, my levels of attention and my levels of anger were too high. And so yesterday I shut everything off and shut everything down and walked with the dog for a long time and just really, really tried to press reset and give myself some space and time. Because a lot of people, when it's bad, call me and do all these welfare checks, but I'm so far gone on the adrenaline that I don't hear them and I don't take them as real check-ins, and they are real. And there's people saying, I've got your back when you need me. And it's really hard for me to say, okay, this is a time I need you. And Sunday was a big time where I needed people and talked to my best friend, my mom's best friend, and talked to some of my best friends that have lost their moms, and then woke up brighter on Monday because I took the time to cry and have those conversations. But like, we can't all be rock stars all the time, and we can't all be strong all the time. And actually the tiny conversations and the tiny hugs, and a friend came this morning to walk the dog with me, those bolster me for a lot more.
One of the things that I've said before as well here on the podcast is that no flower blossoms all year round. And I think that's important for you as well, Jamie, that it is important to take a step back, because with, you know, the change that you can make in this day and age happens at such a fast rate. It's never happened like that before. I mean, just imagine like Martin Luther King trying to organize marches. He had to put like posters on lampposts to get people to come. Like now, overnight you raised, you know, so much money, and it's great, but it's also really exhausting. And I think people need to remember that.
And the women that come before me that have been fighting for visibility and fighting for funding and fight, like austerity has hurt all of us. And those domestic violence charities that like, and mental health stuff, when people are on the streets that shouldn't be on the streets and they're violent, and we're the ones that are taking the hits. So it's not easy. I wish I had solutions for sobriety. I wish I had solutions for addictions to food. For me, the CBT stuff really, really worked, and asking for help. So I cope in Camden, the Women and Girls Center. I've gotten lots and lots of counseling from them. And I'm very honest about the fact that I was at breaking points a bunch of times and I was crumbling, and counseling is a lifesend, like it's a godsend for me, and I need it. And it really, really helps me all the time. And I have no shame about it. But I know that the waiting lists are really long and things happen that are really hard. And so the most we can do in terms of supporting each other and calling out bad behavior and calling out stuff, like for Dr. Duff, you know, like this has to stop. We deserve better and we will demand better.
Yeah. And Jamie, what's next for Reclaim the Streets now? I mean, there's obviously a lot going on and I'm sure there's a lot more cases for you to fight, but what are your next steps now?
So we work with Shout Out UK about consent and respect workshops for kids, especially boys. And we're going to get trained in those and be in some schools so that we can actually talk to kids. Because actually the education side is really, really important, and raising better boys and raising boys that don't believe it's okay. We were talking about highway code. I'm talking about trying to get yelling at women out of cars in the highway code so that when they study for their test, it's in there. And it's a really cheap behavioral deterrent. But things like that, like there's a difference if two boys that are teenagers are in a car and one of them yells something at a woman and the other kid in the car is like, that's disgusting. Why would you do that to her? If it's socially not acceptable, then that becomes what makes the behavior stop. Me yelling on TV about it isn't going to stop that kid's behavior. It becoming social pariah land that your friends don't talk to you if you're an ass, that's where we shift. And like, that's the shifts that we need to accelerate and we need to help happen. And to do that, we need male allies and we need men on our side. And there's so many of them that don't know what to do. So it's having conversations that we're not dumbing down and we're not acting like they're four-year-olds. And it's talking about ways that men can call out the behavior. And like, if you're in a social group, you know what guy is a creep. If you're in a work group, I know what guys, I would say, don't ever be alone with him. Don't ever share a cab with him. And we all know what that is, but we don't formalize that and we don't call it out because we're scared of all different kinds of reasons. And so it's more a way to make it socially unacceptable to be handsy and be lechy and be a creep, because the stuff they're doing in public is a lot less worse than the stuff they're doing in private, and we need to stop all of it.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, Jamie. I mean, this has been a great conversation and I love all the work that you do. And if people want to get involved with the work that you do, how can they do that and how?
So we're also trying to figure out the ways that we can use volunteers, because we don't want people to waste their time. And that's really strategically what we need to work on this year, because we don't want women to come up and be all excited and it not feel like the way that they can engage well. So we are working on that. But the court case is where our focus has been. And hopefully in the next 3 weeks, we will know if we change the law, which I do think there's ways to do things through protest, and there's ways to change in court, and you need both.
Well, thank you so much, Jamie. I hope our listeners can get something from this. You've achieved so much in 1 year that people usually take a lifetime to achieve. But I do think a lot of us have been in this sort of vacuum of the pandemic. And as you mentioned, it has accelerated a lot of change. But if people want to follow your work, do they just hop onto Twitter, or does Reclaim the Streets have a website?
Yeah, and it's reclaimthestreets.com or Twitter for me.
I can say you'll definitely enjoy Jamie's tweets.
I tweet a lot. I've been on Twitter for 15 years. I'm on Twitter way too much. It's my playground. And apologies to everyone for my cursing, but my mom's no longer going to yell at me about it, so I curse a lot.
Thank you so much, Jamie.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in this week again. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did with Jamie. I have more guests coming along in the next few weeks, and I'm just so excited to share them with you. If you want to follow Jamie's work, just remember you can just hop onto Twitter at Jamie Klinger. On Instagram, she's at PhotoGirlUK. I'll put her links on the episode description, which you can find on your podcast app or on the website. And you can follow Reclaim These Streets as well, and head over to their website to see all of the incredible work that they're doing. Thank you again, and I can't wait to see you all next week.